Welcome to this episode of Just the Disc. My name is Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. So this episode, I thought I would run through a short pile of Warner Archive Blu-rays. They are a company, as I've said many times, that I dig very much, despite there sometimes being a lack of extras on their discs, because the transfers are almost always top-notch, and sometimes that's just as important to me as, you know, some kind of extra setup. So I've got five discs here, and I'm going to kick it off with a recent release from them, and that is Gaslight from 1944.
Oh, voila. You might give me your brooch so I can have it repaired. What's the matter? Anything wrong?
No, it's... Oh, Gregory, I can't find it.
What?
I missed it when we were in the tower. I must turn everything out. I know it was here. I can't understand it. I couldn't have lost it. It must be here.
I'm sure it's there.
It's not.
Oh, Paula, didn't I tell you? How did you come to lose it?
I must have pulled it out with something, I suppose. Oh, I'm terribly sorry, Gregory. Please forgive me.
Oh, forgive, my dear. It's not as serious as that. It's not valuable.
But your present to me, your mother's brooch, and I wanted to wear it always. I don't remember opening my bag. Well, I suppose I must have... You did put it in there.
Don't you even remember that?
Yes. Yes, of course I do. Well, suddenly I'm beginning not to trust my memory at all.
Paula, I tell you, you're just tired, that's all. It doesn't mean anything. I'm sure it doesn't. Don't worry so, Paula. Don't worry.
The back of this one says, "Lights flicker and dim, footsteps sound from a sealed-off attic. Mysterious events only vulnerable young Paula sees and hears make her fear she's losing her mind. Exactly what treacherous spouse Gregory hopes." Directed by George Cukor, which I always forget. This is pretty cool. Gaslight shines as a superb exercise in suspense. Ingrid Bergman won her first Academy Award as Paula, doubting her sanity while clinging to it. Fellow Oscar nominee Charles Boyer skillfully plays against type as smoothly evil Gregory. Joseph Cotten, Dame Mae Whitty, and an 18-year-old Angela Lansbury in her movie debut, also capturing an Oscar nomination, helped make the Victorian era vividly realized through production design that earned an Academy Award. So, this movie is based on the play by Patrick Hamilton, and it's become like a pop culture word. You know, when you say somebody's trying to make you think you're crazy, you say somebody's gaslighting you, it's just one of those things where it's become 100% iconic. And it's really interesting to me because I don't know that a lot of people that use the word even have seen this movie or know what it is. So that's kind of neat when a movie or whatever transcends and becomes, you know, a buzzword. But anyway, this is a really great film, and I think sometimes I cross elements of this with Rebecca, even though they're different casts and the stories are different. But it's amazing to me how much drama they wring from these like tiny situations, you know, like Ingrid Bergman marries Charles Boyer and they go to live in her aunt's old apartment where her aunt was killed, strangled, and he immediately starts messing with her. You know, he gives her a brooch that's like really dear to him, and of course like makes sure that she loses it, and then starts talking about her losing things, and it's just sometimes subtle, sometimes not, but absolutely diabolical. I'm not even a huge Charles Boyer fan. I like him in the original Love Affair. I think that's pretty great, him and Irene Dunne. But I don't know, there's something a little stuffy is not quite the right word. I don't know, he's just less accessible to me for some reason, but he is fantastic in this movie. And he has a couple beats that he has to play in the film here with just his eyes and a little bit of his face. And one of them is like a, I have just come up with a brilliant diabolical plan. And the other is like a holy shit. But both are great fun. And it's amazing to see how he plays both with just his eyes, you know? So anyway, this was a really enjoyable rewatch. And this Blu-ray looks stunning, of course. You know, they did a great job, and it's just beautiful. I love Blu-ray black and white. It's just great stuff. So this is highly recommended, you know? It's a great performance by Ingrid Bergman, and when you get to the end, it's just like a revenge movie, you know? It really gets you going, and you just want to see comeuppance. And anyway, it's really well played. So I definitely recommend it. This Blu-ray comes with some special features. One is the original 1940 British version of the film, which unfortunately is in SD. I checked. I thought maybe they would have mastered for HD, but they didn't. And so it looks, you know, obviously it doesn't look as good by any stretch. It also comes with a 1945 Lux Radio Theater broadcast, Reflections on Gaslight, which includes Angela Lansbury and, you know, her giving her thoughts. It's a neat little featurette thing.
I hope you're not a flighty girl, Lucy.
My name's Nancy, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry, Nancy. Are you?
I don't think so, sir.
I'm glad to hear that. Your mistress is very particular about everything being very correct.
Is she, sir?
Yes. And so am I.
17 years old, totally inexperienced, but nevertheless, I was ready to go, if you know what I mean. I'd made a test, and I had decided that this was a wonderful opportunity, and I blooming well better be good.
Did you ring for something, Mum?
Yes, please fetch a cab.
I thought you would come.
Get a cab, Nancy.
George Cukor was simply marvellous. He greeted me. He called me Miss Lansbury. And we started immediately into quite an important scene.
If you want coal on the fire, Paula, why don't you ring for the maid?
A scene in the film where Mr. Boyer asks Ingrid to ring for the maid and have her bring in some coal. And she says, oh, but I can do it myself. He said, no, don't call her. So that was the first scene we did, actually, in which I brought the coal in, finally. And I was my immediate naughty and rather cheeky self.
Little coal on the fire, please, Nancy.
Very good, madam.
You're looking very pretty this afternoon, Nancy. You know that?
I don't know it at all, sir, I'm sure.
Tonight is your night out, isn't it?
That's right, sir.
Whom are you meeting tonight? You might like the gas too, Nancy. I see they've changed the policeman on the beat. Is his heart going to be added to the list of those you've broken?
Didn't I have broken any?
Oh, no, I'm sure that's not true.
There is a reminiscence by Pia Lindstrom about her mother, Ingrid Bergman, which is also cool. 1944 Academy Awards ceremonies newsreel and a trailer. Anyway, Gaslight, it's a good disc. I forgot to mention Joe Cotton is great in it. I like him a lot. And yeah, the three of them are just so dynamic. It's really a great little thriller. So check out Gaslight. And speaking of thrillers, I had never seen this next disc. I'd never seen this movie. And it was just one that I, for some reason, never got around to. I think because I've never been a huge fan of Misery, and I always associated Misery with this film. And that is Dolores Claiborne from 1995.
I'm just muzzy here trying to think what to say. All grown up, looking so... You turned out a beautiful woman, Selena. Just can't believe you're here.
That makes two of us. Sure, there's a very good reason for why you'd go out of your way to antagonize them like that.
Sometimes being a bitch is all a woman has to hold on to. Nice car.
It's a rental.
Pay by the day or by the week?
I assume that's your way of asking how long I'm staying.
Corey, you're more nervous than I am.
I have to be in Phoenix on Monday. It's a big story. I'm trying to get out of it. But it may not be possible, all right?
I didn't kill her. I didn't push her down that friggin' staircase. That's what you want to know, ain't it? And I'm telling you, I did not murder that bitch any more than I'm wearing a diamond tiara.
He's got an eyewitness. Puts you standing over a dead body with a rolling pin.
Since when did you start smoking?
Are you not listening to me? They're talking murder here. You're lucky I didn't have to post bail.
The back says, Selena St. George stares at a note in a news clipping. Her estranged mother, Dolores, has been accused of murder. Grudgingly, Selena returns to her tiny Maine hometown to offer help. Not that she believes Dolores is innocent. In truth, she harbors suspicions going back 20 years. Kathy Bates, who won a Best Actress Oscar for Misery, scores in another chilling Stephen King story, directed by Taylor Hackford, as tough-talking Dolores Claiborne. Jennifer Jason Leigh is wrenching as embittered Selena, her daughter. The two circle warily, piecing together past and present memory and fact to reveal the startling truth behind two mysterious deaths. So yeah, this is a really great movie. And like I said, I can't believe I hadn't seen it. It features a script by the great Tony Gilroy, which apparently goes beyond King's book and does some interesting things with the text and expands them. And, you know, it's discussed in the commentary track, which I definitely recommend you listen to. I'll talk about that in a second. But the cast is really strong. You've got, obviously, Kathy Bates and Jennifer Jason Leigh. Both are great. Eric Bogosian, Christopher Plummer is fantastic as this, like, sort of, he's like a higher-up sheriff, and he's coming in to investigate the murder. Basically, the movie opens with what looks to be maybe an accidental death, but there's some room for speculation, let's say, and Christopher Plummer's character has it in for Dolores Claiborne, and we kind of find out through the course of the movie why he's got this thing with her, and he's great. And John C. Reilly plays like the local constable that he's sort of working in conjunction with, who is like, you know, doesn't have previous history with Dolores, really, in terms of what's going on. So there's an interesting dynamic there. And then Dolores works for a woman named Vera Donovan, and that's played by Judy Parfitt, and she is spectacular. I've never seen her in anything else that I'm aware of, but she's really good. And then David Strathairn plays Kathy Bates's husband and Jennifer Jason Leigh's father. And, you know, there's some sort of details that are left out that we start to piece together about, you know, that whole relationship. So there's a lot that unfolds. And one of the things I love about the movie is that it really has these nicely integrated flashbacks. Kind of reminds me of Lone Star, I want to say a couple, the next year. No, it was 96, I think, where you'll, you know, pan across a scene and suddenly we're in flashback, or we'll wipe with something, and it's just really well done. And Taylor Hackford talks about designing that stuff, and I love the flow of it. It really makes the movie so fluid in terms of time, and that's really a neat thing, I gotta say. So I kind of loved it. Yeah, it's. I won't say any more about what happens. It's really a movie that's great to watch unfold, you know? But like I said, it does feature a commentary track from director Taylor Hackford, and he has a lot of interesting things to say about the film. You know, he'll start with the, you know, casting and just the general genesis of the project, talking about Tony Gilroy's adaptation and some of the changes or extensions he made. He talks about, like, a Bergman influence.
Now let's talk about the look of the film. If you'll see, you know, there's a blue tinge to this. It's desaturated. And Bruno Robeo, who is my production designer, who is one of my closest collaborators and starts with me very early on, is someone, you know, not only that establishes locations, but general look of the film. And then my collaborator, Gabriel Berenstein, who is my director of photography. Both Bruno and Gabriel work with me on Blood In, Blood Out, a Chicano gangster picture I did at Disney. And we established, along with Josh McLaughlin, the first AD, a very strong working team. Gabrielle and I were particularly fond of Bergman's movies, for instance, Passion of Anna, that Sven Nyquist had shot in Sweden, where you really desaturated the color. The north and the cold of the north in Passion of Anna was so present to me. And I wanted to, I'd asked Gabri to see the film and Bruno to see the film because I wanted to try to capture some of that. The first part of this film, which is in the present, is devoid of emotion. You feel that Dolores' life is devoid of any kind of warmth. She's living in this, and you're about to see where she lives, in this craggy outcropping of rock outside of town. It's cold. It's windblown. The boards have been bleached by salt and weather, as she has been bleached by salt and weather. And I thought that the look of this film, we have two distinct looks, should be bloodless, having lost a great deal of life and passion.
Which I thought was really neat, and I totally hadn't thought about, but when you watch the movie, you can kind of feel it. I mean, it's a little more heightened and intense. Well, Bergman can get pretty intense sometimes, but I kind of felt that, and I thought that was a really neat thing to have in the mix. Yeah, I mean, he's really great just about discussing his process, and I enjoyed the commentary quite a bit. You know, it makes me want to seek out other commentaries. He talked about things like different film stocks they used for the flashbacks, you know, and that was something that was kind of neat. Like, you would sometimes see the stock change, and it sort of puts you in the past in this really cool way.
Now you're about to see the first transition back into the past. And again, I did this in a way that would allow us in a subtle way to understand that Dolores, we're seeing this from Dolores' point of view. You see we're in the present here. See the blue? But when we cut out, we're shooting in a new film stock. We're shooting in Fuji. Fuji and Kodak have totally different characteristics. Fuji is pastel. It has a warmth to it. And the warmth, I thought, fit particularly well with Dolores and her past feelings. You know, there was hope. She's youthful. She's got hope in her life. She's hoping things work. And in this instance, you go to the past, you kind of flow into it, and then you're jerked back to the present. You know, these scenes are designed. I storyboarded them. I have very specific ideas and then worked with special effects people to get those transitions to be seamless. And I think all the way, I'm very proud. Some of the best work I think I've ever done in this film in terms of designing the transitions to really tell the story, to make it flow back and forward. So Fuji is shot for the past, and Kodak, which has a very cool feeling to it. Fuji's warm, Kodak is cool. And then we desaturated and blued the Kodak to give it even a colder feeling. You may not like it, but it's a artistic choice we made.
Yeah, it was just, like I said, really well executed, well thought out, well directed. Very solid movie, and like a discovery for me this year, you know, like because I hadn't gotten around to it. So highly recommended, Dolores Claiborne. Next up, we have an old favorite of mine, and that is Big Wednesday from 1978.
In the old days, I remember a wind that would blow down through the canyons. It was a hot wind called a Santana, and it carried with it the smell of warm places. It blew the strongest before dawn across the point. My friends and I would sleep in our cars, and the smell of the offshore wind would often wake us. And each morning, we knew this would be a special day.
The back says, no matter what rolled in on the tides of time, California surfing buddies Matt, Jack, and Leroy knew they'd stick together, and that they'd be ready when a rare 20-foot swell hit the coast at last. Big Wednesday celebrates surfing as much as the most dedicated kid who ever waxed a board. It's also a fascinating 1962 to 1974 chronicle of friendships and lifestyles in transition. John Milius, Apocalypse Now, Red Dawn, directs and co-scripts with a passion for the ultimate ride and a truthful feel for those turbulent times. Stars Jan Michael Vincent and William Catt are accomplished surfers, and co-lead Gary Busey of Point Break learned for the role. and the vivid camera work drops you inside awesome barrels of ocean blue. So this is, to me, John Milius' best film. It's his most personal film. It is culled from a lot of his own personal experience surfing around this time, and the characters are modeled on people he knew, sometimes composites and combinations of characters, but it's definitely a movie that has a lot of heart, and there is a sense of John Ford. I remember seeing a documentary about the movie Bratz, and one woman critic said something about that this is imbued with John Ford and his sense of mythologizing the past, which is something I hadn't even thought about in terms of what Ford does. But if you think about it, it's definitely something that he sort of makes a part of his storytelling, you know? And this movie is very much that. It's very much, you know, like a John Ford surfing movie, but there's a whole lot of other stuff in the mix, you know? I think it is definitely carried by the three leads. William Catt, Chan Michael Vincent, and Gary Busey are fantastic, as good as they've ever been. And they just absolutely destroy in these roles. Like, I love them. These are some of my favorite performances by these actors.
Oh, I swear to God, I'm never gonna drink again.
If she just hadn't passed out, it'd have been okay.
Where's your surfboard? In my car.
Where's your car?
I don't know.
Wait, stop. Wait a minute. Look at that.
You did swell.
Look, wait a minute. If you want to come through this gate and go down these steps, you have to do it on your own.
I remember the three friends best. Matt, Jack, Leroy. It was their time. They were the big names then. The kings. Our own royalty. It was really their place. And their story.
I'm Leroy the masochist. I live here. My friend is close to death, and we need to get him in the water. He doesn't have a board. Could we possibly use your fine...
Hey, man. Don't lend my stick to anyone. Sorry, but...
Well, I understand what you mean about not lending your board to anybody. Let me introduce you to Matt Johnson. He lives here, along with myself and Mr. Barlow, and we need to get him in the water. Could I please, Bart, I'll bring it back to you personally, my word of honor.
Can't lend my stick to some hodad, man.
He's not a hodad, Squid Lips. I told you that's Matt Johnson. Can I please use your board?
My dad just bought this.
Come on. I want to use your board. That's all I'm going to do to you right now. What?
You can use my
board. Okay, good. Thank you. Back over here. Johnson! I've got a vehicle.
I mean, I could say it's like Milius's American Graffiti on surfboards. I mean, that's kind of it, but in a lot of ways, I prefer it to American Graffiti, which I know is a bold thing to say, but I don't know. There's just something really powerful about the movie and emotional and melancholy. And it just gets me every time. I remember, I think the first time I heard of the movie, and I've definitely mentioned this at some point on some podcast, was that it was on a list of Tarantino's favorite films at one point. And he said something like he loved the movie and that he knew some surfers and that they didn't deserve a movie this good or something like that, which I always found amusing. But, you know, it's a pretty great movie. And I was very excited that Warner Archive put this one out on Blu-ray. It looks great. It includes the director, co-writer John Milius commentary, which is wonderful. Just hearing him reflect on the production and talk about, you know, this or that thing that was inspired by real life events or real people. It's just really a delightful thing to hear him reminisce as he watches the movie, not only about the production itself, but about his young life. And, you know, just so interesting to me that he had this whole thing as a surfer, you know.
I think of myself strictly as a storyteller, and that I'm telling the story in the most efficient way. And I try and tell it with arresting images. I try and I'm not so concerned with exactly how pretty the thing is going to be as long as they're powerful and meaningful images. I cast this with the idea that these characters would all look kind of heroic. They wouldn't look just like kids. They They were to look like young men, you know, that there was something they were going to go ahead and do in life. And so, you know, that was something I had in mind, as well as the fact that I wanted to get the best surfers. I had to have surfers. And so Jan Michael and Billy Cat were both pretty good recreational surfers, but not in the class we would need to do the real surfing. But they did a lot of surfing themselves, and there's a nice piece right there and a few other pieces here where you see Jan Michael really actually surfing. They did get a little better as time went on, you know, and I don't want to disparage their surfing. Of course, they weren't like the rest of us, who were all world class. Like the surfers that came before us. This is Excalibur right here. He's building Excalibur, and this is one of the major themes, that things are passed down, and whether or not you can live up to them, traditions. Of course, this board means an awful lot, and the idea that he brings up here, that there will be a day, a big day, because people will be tested. Life is going to test you. There is a consequence. This idyllic world they live on, and you know, live in, and all the things that happen to them is not going to stay the same. Life is going to interfere with it, and that's going to be how they're going to be judged. And of course, on the big day, they're expected to become something. They're expected to become more than just surfers, and that's when this board will be ridden.
I remember another thing I heard in that same documentary was, I want to say it was like somebody said that he, Milius, had discovered Kurosawa while surfing in Hawaii, and there's definitely a bit of like Kurosawa in here too. Like, I can't put my finger on specifics. It's just about, it's the vibe. It's something. It's really an interesting mix. But anyway, it's a great commentary. And then there is also a retrospective documentary called Capturing the Swell, which is neat as well. I definitely dug that. So that's Big Wednesday. Definitely a favorite. Absolutely worth a pickup. Okay, next up I have, I'm not going to say guilty pleasure because it's just a pleasure. Like, it's one of my favorite disaster movies, and it's definitely much maligned, reasonably so. It's also epically long. It's 156 minutes, you know, just shy of 3 hours. Of course, I'm talking about The Swarm, also from 1978.
Good morning, ladies, gentlemen. Please forgive the haste and the secrecy with which you have been summoned here. The fact is, we have been invaded by a mutant species of the African killer bee.
Crane, if I may.
Yes, Dr. Hubbard.
As you know, I was sent by the president here to help out, but I think you are dead wrong. Now, I was one of the first people sent to Brazil to study the situation when the African killer bee began proliferating there. Incidentally, we prefer to call these mutants the Brazilian bee, not the African.
Yes, I'm very well aware of that, Dr. Hubbard.
Well, I've been keeping track of their progress north, and I can assure you there is no evidence whatsoever that they've yet crossed Central America, let alone arrived here.
Apparently, they came directly across the Caribbean from Venezuela. There have been three hurricanes in that ocean track in the past season. Any one of them could have swept the bees in. Much of the land around here is given over to the cultivation of flowers, a perfect breeding ground.
Gentlemen, with all appropriate respect for the men who died here, there is no proof that the bees that killed them were Brazilian, or, if you insist, African.
What we call them is not as important as what they are. And what they are, quite clearly, is a mutant species of the original African killer bee. Dr. Krim will explain.
The autopsies confirm that the venom is deadlier than anything we've ever encountered. It appears there's enough poison in just four stings to kill the average person.
Back says, monsters by the millions, and they're all for real. And then it says, producer-director Irwin Allen, The Poseidon Adventure, Towering Inferno, now unleashes an end-of-the-world thriller based on scientific fact. In Africa and South America, killer bees are a reality. Now, The Swarm is on the move into North America. There are enough stars for 5 movies. Michael Caine, Catherine Ross, Richard Widmark, Olivia de Havilland, Henry Fonda, Fred McMurray, Richard Chamberlain, Jose Ferrer, Patty Duke Aston, Lee Grant, and Bradford Dillman, among others. But the scene stealers are the supporting cast, an estimated 22 million bees, deftly deployed to depict deadly attacks on people and places. It's a nightmare that will give you quite a buzz. Great copy. So, as you heard from an episode not too long ago, I love animal attack movies. I also love disaster movies, and this is both. And I don't know what to say about it that would help anyone else overcome its shortcomings. You know, it's filled with silly stuff like bee POV shots, menacing close-ups of bees, and people being attacked by lots of bees in slow motion, which actually just looks kind of ridiculous as they're just like swatting and flailing around, and the music is really intense. I mean, yeah, it's still terrifying. I would hate to get swarmed by bees, but there's just something about the way it looks. There's even a bonkers scene in a hospital where a kid whose parents are killed by bees hallucinates a gigantic bee in the room with him, and Michael Caine has to sort of like talk him down. It's pretty nuts. There's also a great moment early in the film where they cut from like a bee attack to this like small town square, and they're putting up the banners for their local flower festival. And you're just like, oh man, this place is in trouble. It's just got a lot of stuff packed into it, you know, like soapy melodrama romance, love triangle between Olivia de Havilland, Fred McMurray, and Ben Johnson. Like that's one subplot. And then you've got the whole conflict between Michael Caine, who's like an entomologist, and Richard Widmark, who's like a high-ranking military dude. And he's been told to help Michael Caine. And so there's like this butting of heads there. But yeah, I mean, it's just, and Henry Fonda's like another scientist guy. It's nuts. And a lot of people get killed by bees in this movie. And yeah, I just love it. I remember being in grade school and hearing about the killer bees. And there was this whole hysteria about them coming north into the States. And, you know, I realize that it's sort of happened already in some ways, but it's never been like quite like this. Yeah, and I don't know how I thought that the bees were going to get from South America all the way up into Wisconsin where I lived, like, and live through all the winters and all this stuff. It like freaked me out, but I couldn't in my head realize that it was probably not likely to affect me, but I was terrified of bees, and even more so when this sort of phenomenon began around that time. So anyway, I've always dug this movie. It is sort of the best of both worlds in terms of the big disaster animals attack. I found a really great clip of Irwin Allen himself, and he's actually talking about Towering Inferno at the time, but he sort of gives like a blanket statement about why he thinks the disaster movies have a certain appeal to the masses.
Well, I think Towering Inferno falls into the same category as Poseidon, which was the leader, the number one of the disaster genre. I have a private theory about this. I think really we're all Walter Mitty's. We stand in front of the mirror in the morning and we conjure up some great experience we're going to have on that particular day. And we go out and face the world attempting to be heroes. Because the truth is, we'd all like to be heroes. When you couple that with what I think is a basic problem in human nature, I think there's something missing in our individual ids. And I think, strangely enough, and unhappily, we all like to attend accidents. You've never seen an automobile crash that didn't have 50, 60 people around it. You never saw a fire engine racing through the streets that wasn't followed by a crowd of kids and some grown-ups. And when I finally reached the fire, one of the greatest difficulties is to hold back the fire line. The combination of wanting to be the heroic Walter Mitty character and the fact that we enjoy accidents makes the present disaster movie the hits that they are. It gives the Walter Mitties of the world an opportunity to vicariously enjoy the thrill of being a hero while watching a terrible disaster in which they can't be hurt in the comfort of a theater seat. The problem with our individual ids is that we're all madly attracted to disaster. And I think those two, more than anything else, plus the way you put it on the screen, result in the success of the disaster film, and for which I'm terribly grateful.
But yeah, there's just a lot of great scenes with Michael Caine you know, talking to military officials or talking to press conferences and generally getting irritated and raising his voice a lot about, you know, take this seriously because people are getting killed. And it's true, but he's really pretty intense in this movie. And it's entertaining. I got to say, it's really entertaining. So this one ports over a behind-the-scenes documentary called Inside the Swarm, which is, I want to say, like 20 minutes, maybe. It includes interviews with, you know, the cast, and it shows behind the scenes of them shooting certain scenes. You know, like there's a scene where, like, I think an airplane set is on a gimbal and they're rocking it back and forth, and you see Irwin Allen directing, and it's interesting. It's neat to see his process and listen to what the actors talk about it. I mean, it's, you know, your standard somewhat fluffy PR stuff, but I don't see too many disaster movie interviews with Olivia de Havilland and stuff, so I kind
of
dig that.
This kind of film, I think, has an awful lot of value because people, the general public, all of us, run the risk of being threatened by these bees.
A swarm of African bees could trigger something that could trigger something that could trigger something that trigger something bigger that could be disaster.
No, doctor. See this. Billions of dollars have been spent to make these nuclear plants safe. Fail safe. The odds against anything going wrong are astronomical, doctor.
I appreciate that, doctor. But let me ask you. In all your fail safe techniques, is there any provision against an attack by killer bees?
Anyway, it is a widescreen movie, and so I kind of love having it on Blu-ray. It looks really nice. And the bee effects are that much more engaging in high def. Anyway, so that is The Swarm. It is one that I, you know, have a great fondness for and definitely recommend if you're into disaster movies. So lastly on my stack is a movie that should be more well-known, partially because it is absolutely 100% the basis for Pixar's movie Cars, which a lot of people know, and that is Doc Hollywood from 1991.
Okay, question. Beverly Hills, the most beautiful woman in the world, plastic surgery. What do these three things have in common? Me in less than a week.
Oh, my God.
I think I can fix that.
We want to hear all about California.
I heard that the women out there have their chests enlarged, their thighs vacuumed and barfed on purpose.
We are prepared to offer you a permanent position as medical practitioner supreme here in the greater, greater metropolitan area and squash capital of the South. Will all in favor say aye?
Aye.
I'm in the Twilight Zone.
Just on my way to Beverly Hills. Plastic surgery. Not that you need any.
I suspect your version of romance is whatever will separate me from my panties.
All I'm talking about is dinner. Wear a dress. Panties are optional.
Don't you have some kind of urgent business thousands of miles away from here, Doctor?
He was a man with big plans, but he never planned on her. Michael J. Fox.
Morning, Doc! That's a nice pig you got there.
Yeah, that's what they tell me.
Julie Warner.
You can blink now.
Woody Harrelson.
I could have gone to med school. Just the science part of it I had a problem with.
And Bridget Fonda.
Do doctors know more about sex?
Doc Hollywood.
So the back says, Dr. Ben Stone, Michael J. Fox, is a newly minted MD whose medical fast lane cruise takes a small town detour. Grady, South Carolina, squash capital of the South, is home to salt of the earth folks, Julie Warner, Woody Harrelson, Bridget Fonda, David Ogden Stiers, Barnard Hughes, who give the West Coast bound hotshot the seasoning he lacks. Doc Hollywood is a surefire prescription for comedy cheer. Yeah, so this is the story of this you know, hotshot doctor who is on his way to California, gets stuck in South Carolina, and his car breaks down. He crashes his car, and he is definitely trying to get out as quickly as possible. He is not initially won over by the small town charm, as it were, of this little community and their squash festival and their laid back ways and their approach to medicine. He really goes at this older doctor. They just don't hit it off because there's an initial conflict where he misdiagnoses something that this doctor has told him about, and that's Barnard Hughes, who I like very much. He's a nice older actor. He's a great cranky doctor in this. This also has Frances Sternhagen. She is one of the, she works for the welcoming committee. I don't know. And David Ogden Stiers is the mayor. He's great. And Bridget Fonda, his daughter, is interesting. She's trying to get out of town. And then later George Hamilton plays a doctor in LA, and it's an interesting, cast all around. Robert's Blossom is there. I feel like there are some other recognizable people, but regardless, it's one of those movies that's definitely schmaltz, but Michael J. Fox being in the lead is what I think helps it get over the hump in terms of that, because he doesn't play that many kind of dick characters. I mean, he has played some in his day. I guess I'm thinking Alex P. Keaton is kind of a dick. That's one of his most famous roles. Anyway, I think I just think of Marty McFly, like a lot of people, and how, you know, he's a good-hearted guy. And this character seems much more superficial and much more focused on, like, trying to pick up Julie Warner in the, you know, 1 or 2 days he's going to be there. And she's very resistant because she knows he's leaving. And so they have an interesting romantic development. But yeah, it's just one of those things where you kind of are won over, I think, by this small town. And you kind of are like, yeah, I could see why these people stay where they are, and the sort of advantages and, like I said, laid back lifestyle. There's something about that that is very appealing, and it becomes a choice situation. You know, does he stick around or does he go to LA? And that's kind of the dramatic crux of the movie. And, you know, it's neat to watch it play out. And with such a great cast, it's kind of a pleasure. So anyway, this one, I don't know if the DVD was in full frame. It might have been. So this, I think Warner Archive actually released a widescreen DVD of this. But for a long time, you could only watch this full frame, 4x3. And so it's nice to have it actually in its original 1.85 or 1.781 aspect ratio. And it looks very nice. So I don't know. It's a neat little movie directed by Michael Caton Jones, who did Memphis Belle, among other things. And it's, like I said, the basis for Cars. If you watch Cars, it's 100% that movie is ripping this off. So I don't know. There's something cute about that. It's definitely better than Cars. Not that I'm bagging on Cars. It's just, it's fine. But yeah, Michael J. Fox is so well known for certain films that I feel like it's nice to spotlight some other ones that don't get that much attention. And this seems like one that definitely has a following because of him, but that hasn't had a great track record on home video. And it's really nice to see it in high def. So anyway, that will do it for my stack of Warner Archive Blu-rays. I hope they will be having a sale sometime soon. I don't know when. But definitely keep an eye on their Twitter feed and their Facebook feed for their 4 for 44 sale, which is, you know, $11 a disc. And obviously you can get more than 4 discs. Once you hit 4, everything is $11. So you can get 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, whatever. It doesn't have to be increments of 4. So it's a really great deal, $11 Blu-rays, and they have a lot of great stuff. And I'll try and do another one of these, hopefully before the next sale. But if not, definitely go back and check out Rob G. and I's Warner Archive Love episode. We talk about a lot of stuff that is highly recommended for picking up from them, if nothing on this episode appeals to you. Anyway, have a lovely and Blu-ray-filled week, and I will talk to you very soon. Bye-bye.